The following program is for entertainment and basic informational purposes only. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of Cumulus Media, WPRV Radio, its management, or staff. This is Rhode Island's longest-running financial talk show, Money Talk with Don Soa. With market insights and so much more, talk to Don now at 437-5000 or 1-888-345-0790. This is Money Talk with Don Soa.
And I welcome you to the Money Talk program, everybody. My name is Don Soa. Delighted to have you here joining us on AM 790, your home of talk and business here in southern New England. The Money Talk program is, we're in our 26th year on the air, sharing your drive time home with you. I hope, needless to say, I'm sure that most of you who are listening to the program have listened to all 26 years of the show, except for those of you who are 25 or 26.
We have very, very loyal listeners.
I joke about it, but I do find it interesting the number of people that that actually have said that they heard the first few years of the show back in the early days, back in the early 90s. I said, well, that gives the age. But I think what pleased me even more than that, and yes, we love loyal listeners, but what pleased me even more than that was running into younger people like millennials who were in their 20s and 30s and having them say.
Once you get up after you fell over from realizing that people that young listen to your show.
Because it's interesting, some of the questions that we get from the show do come from younger, clearly from younger listeners. Because they're giving you some demographic information about, they're applying for information for themselves, a decision that they have to make. And I remember one particular case, that says, oh, love your show. They start off with all this complimentary stuff. They said, look, I'm in my mid-20s. I'm just starting my first real full-time job after school. I finished grad school. And in about 2 months, I'm going to be eligible for the 401k plan at work. So they started to ask questions about the approach to 401k.
You know, for all the flack that millennials get from older generations, one pretty common characteristic is that as a group, they tend to research and self-educate. So before they will just go to a doctor, before they will go to, any professional, including financial advisors, they're going to want to do their research, know how to ask smart questions, and get a lot of information first so that they really are a partner in the decision making. That's a pretty common characteristic of that group. So it would make sense that we would have listeners, even if they're not ready to come work with a financial advisor yet, those listeners are getting ready.
And they're open-minded and they can be affected. And the way that I know that, and it's just the simplest ways, our producer falls into that category. And I noticed that when he started producing the Money Talk Get Back to Basics show, he didn't have a beard. But he's been sitting across here looking through the glass at me all this time, and all of a sudden he starts growing a beard. I'm saying, well, you see, even without saying anything about beards, it's influencing him. I think he's going to stop putting baby powder in his beard. He's going to start putting baby powder in it so he starts to look a little bit more like me. The joke with that was, I can remember when I met one of the major guests we ever had on the show back in 1991 was Peter Lynch from Fidelity. Now, Peter was one of those people that had gotten prematurely, not gray, but white. He had that Santa Claus white powdery.
Silver white.
And I said to him, I said, well, I'm wondering if I should put a little bit of gray in my temples or in certain key spots of the beard, or I was starting to get them, and I says I was thinking of actually using some of that something for men or whatever it was.
Oh, you were thinking of getting rid of them.
Getting rid of the color, I says, oh, I'm starting to get a little gray here and there in the temples, and he says, Donald, he says, you manage other people's money for a living. You talk on the radio, you're probably doing television. He says, I promise you, you get a certain amount of credibility for every gray hair in your face and in your hair and on your head.
Does it work that way with women too?
I don't really know.
I don't really know.
I just thought it was kind of interesting that because he's sitting there with his purse powdery white hair, and I said, well, I guess, well, then you must have a whole hell of a lot of credibility there.
He said, yes, I do.
Yes, I do. Now, paying attention, I would imagine, for you, of course, and our people like our producer and anyone who's been listening to the media lately, they did say there was a big, and I think a meaningful security breach at one of the largest of the credit bureaus. There's three primary credit bureaus in this country that most corporations as well as individual consumers do business with. They track our credit information. The role that they play is critically important as part of the process of determining whether individuals that are out there are or should be eligible to borrow money from various institutions. The institutions depend upon them. And we, of course, as consumers, depend upon being able to access that information and get a credit report to see where we do stand so that we won't be so shocked or surprised or waste our time talking to a lender who has no intention of lending us money.
Yeah, that. And one of the things that we look at is we pull our credit reports to make sure that we haven't been the victim of identity theft. You know, one of the things when you go to either take out a mortgage or, you know, get a loan for a car, you'll see right in the loan documents, the report that comes out of companies like, TransUnion, Equifax, and Experian. And when you look at these, it will have a list of all your accounts and the outstanding balances. And it's that's always an opportunity for you to go through and make sure that everything on there actually belongs to you. When we were getting a car loan years ago, I remember my husband's, on his report, there was something on there that did not belong to him, and we had to go have it taken off. But it was through one of these credit bureaus that we found this information. So it really kind of shakes your faith in this when it's one of these companies who has been the victim, I guess you could say, of a security breach. And you know, if you go right through to the Equifax website, they have a tool that you can use to go on and see if you are you put in your name and your a part of your social security number to see if you may have been included in this. And I was. I was, and most people I know probably were too. So,
well, if they say that 100 million,
143,
you know, 143 million people have had their credit information looked into, available. I mean, how it's being used, you don't know that it's being used, but
you don't know when it's going to be used. That's the thing. It's not like they suddenly steal your information and immediately open up accounts.
Well, you know what they can do, though.
I mean,
these
sell it.
These hackers are, because they are entrepreneurs in their own right, they're going to go in there. Now they have this massive resource. They have this massive pile of data, super data, mega data, you might call it, with all those names and social security numbers and dates of birth and all that, all the key information that anybody who wants to steal your stuff would want that information. But the thing is, they get better at it. And this is why a lot of you who are listening now who may have had your information jeopardized and taken as part of this process, may discover it may for the next few years there's no challenge to your credit. There's nobody trying to do anything. But what they typically will do is they will go in and they will mine, the term mining, they will mine that body of information, and they will break it down because they want to make it very, very specific to the potential buyer. In other words, some of the buyers out there are not just looking for, oh, just send me a list of names and social security numbers and dates of birth. No, they want people that fall into certain demographic categories, certain business categories, people who are professionals in a certain career path, maybe a person that may want to specialize with doctors, or there's a whole series of things that they could do. But that mining process makes that. In other words, they may not want 140 million names, but they may say, no, I would like to have about 100,000, but I want them to be very, very specific in a certain category.
And what's important for you to do is know that you really have two choices at this point. You can either go and have your credit monitored, but that doesn't prevent anything, right? Having your credit monitored just means that there's a watchdog watching. It doesn't prevent anything. If you actually want to prevent anything happening, you pretty much have to take an extreme measure, which would be having your credit frozen. And that's a big decision to make, because then if you have to contact all three bureaus, tell them you want to put a freeze on your credit. And then if you need to do something, like you're going to refinance your mortgage, you're going to buy a car, there's any number of things that you could be doing that would require you to utilize your credit. You have to contact them first, and you have to pay probably to have it unfrozen. I've heard the word thaw used before too, which is, you know, getting really descriptive, but yeah, you have to have the credit freeze taken off. So just, you know, understand that whatever you choose to do, if you only choose to have it monitored, if you've been a victim here, you're still at risk. You have to pay close attention to it. If you want to actually prevent anything from happening, you have to make the decision to freeze your credit. Do so knowing that you're not going to be able to access your credit without actually taking the steps to have it unfrozen first.
Yeah, I mean, it comes a problem if you want to apply for a loan or a credit card. Or a lot of people don't think about this, but we've been already hearing in this last week some people who are talking about how it's how they froze their credit immediately when they heard this thing in the news. But one guy didn't realize that he was also in the he had about five or six applications out for jobs.
They run a credit check
and now all of a sudden.
Well, they can.
They go in and they're looking to check and the services that they provide are going out and checking your credit information. They're finding out that these things have been frozen and they don't know why.
Yeah.
In other words, it's not that you don't have credit, but there's no way for them to verify what your credit record is, your payment history, or anything else like that. Some people said that you may delay by an extended period of time not only your ability to get a loan, to refinance your property, to buy a car, or any of those things, but you may all of a sudden add weeks, if not months, to the job seeking process.
So we're not saying don't freeze your credit, but just say if you are going to do it, know what you're doing, and if you might need to utilize your credit report, you're going to have to plan ahead for it, right?
Yeah. The other thing, too, is that it may, in fact, cost you some money. To freeze your credit.
Yes, it will. Not a lot.
There are consumer groups that are trying to said that states should have it as an automatic law that state that you shouldn't be charged to freeze your credit. There's only three primary agencies that you'd be doing it with.
I was going to say, there's three. It's like $10 each, I think. So for $30, you can protect yourself.
I guess there's only a few states I know that Indiana, North Carolina, they've adopted a policy of their own prohibiting bureaus from actually charging any fees to consumers who want to initiate or remove a freeze, because there's a charge to initiate and there's also a charge to remove. Because they're going through a lot of trouble to find out, are you who you say you are? As you go through that process overall. Well, folks, it's the complicated world of money and finance, but we're going to be talking about some specific types, not specifically categories of styles of investing that may be appropriate at this time in the current economy, but sectors of the economy that may be opportunistic at this particular point. Where's the risk and where's the potential reward? This is Get Back to Basics with Donna Sowa Allard and myself. I'm Don Sowa. We'll be right back.
This is Money Talk with Don Sowa, exclusively on AM 790 Talk and Business.
And welcome back to the Money Talk Get Back to Basics program. By the way, for those of you who are regular listeners to AM 790, you're well aware that ongoing during the select times during the week, often following this Money Talk program, is Dave Ramsey's program. And Dave, I've said it many times. I'm sure he wouldn't mind. I mean, I've been doing this a very, very long time. I've actually been doing financial talk on radio longer than he has. But maybe I'm just old. But the bottom line, I don't agree with everything that he says, especially on the investment side. But when it comes to debt, to debt management and that sort of thing, I think that his system doesn't work for everybody, but for the people that it does work for, it's like a godsend. It's pretty unbelievable. So I give them all the credit in the world, and I see great value in the work that he does. He was asked, of course, as you might well imagine, by his listeners about this whole credit freeze thing. He says, when should I freeze my credit? And he said, he says that I almost thought there was maybe a little arrogance in the way he answered it, but he says it does go along with his philosophy. He says, when you've finally gotten to the point where you don't need the credit anymore. He says, I don't borrow money, so I don't need to have a credit report. I don't care if people look at it. He says, basically, so when the opportunity comes up to freeze it, I said, yeah, go ahead and freeze it. You know, that's fine by me, because I don't need the services of those three major credit services that Donna mentioned in the first segment of the show.
But I do. I'm going to need to buy a new car in the next few months, so right now probably isn't a good time for me to freeze my credit.
And there are people also right now who have tuition bills that are going to be coming up, and they've chosen maybe instead of going with a slightly more expensive Sally Mae student loan, that they may actually take some money out of their home.
Line of credit.
They have the ability. It's a lesser expensive choice in terms of the interest on it, and they get to actually deduct that on their tax return, where they don't often have that option when you're dealing with student plus or parents plus type loans. So what's going to happen? Well, you go to apply for that. If you, because of your concern about what happened with this recent hack of credit information, then you're going to suddenly find yourself in a position where it's almost impossible, not completely, but almost impossible to get the credit that you're looking for.
A challenge.
It's a tremendous challenge. like you said, it's a good reason if you're concerned, if you feel that there may be some risk to your information, if you've gotten a notification from one of your credit card companies, for example, that somebody has placed a rather unusual, odd charge on your account in somewhere in Des Moines, and you've never been there. You know, there's a lot of things that go into that process. I like the idea. I mean, I find one of the reasons I've always liked, despite the potential expense or anything, is the American Express company, is that I have never, I've had at least two or three occasions over the years where somebody tried to use my credit card information from American Express.
Well, they're fantastic about letting you know.
And they called up like it was, I loved it. It was 2 p.m. and they said, there's a charge this morning at 10:15 a.m. Now, like, that's 3 hours ago. At 10:15 a.m., it was a store in, and it was on like the West Coast somewhere, and it was computer equipment and some other. And I said, well, what did it come to? This, it was like $4,800 and such and such dollars. I said, look, I'm in Rhode Island. I have not been there. I have not bought any computer equipment in a very, very long time. For my business, I wouldn't put it on this particular card. So I said, yes, somebody is not authorized to use that. They said, fine. We will notify the store, which was doing the before anything was processed.
You know, years ago, my I was using my like bank debit credit card, whatever it is, debit card, yeah. But I would often use it as credit for protection purposes. And I saw that there had been some charges in like British Columbia, Canada.
Geez.
There was charges to a
Nigeria,
like a pizza place. No, it was a pizza place and a flower shop and all this stuff. And so I found it, but I had to go like file a police report and the stuff because it was, you know, with my bank account. But I was so annoyed because, you know, of course the money's returned to me and there's no, you know, I'm made financially whole. There's no issue. But like, I really want to know who did it. Like, who stole my information? Who was using my card? How did this happen? I always wonder that. And I'm always so annoyed that you don't get to find that out.
Well, the thing is, you know that the theft had to occur somewhere near you.
Like,
but the information was sold to someone outside, of course,
like
New England.
Like a card reader or something like that. You know, some way. You know what I'm talking about.
A card reader
on an ATM or something. Like, so annoying.
Now, another thing related to this topic before we go on to our other topic for this evening is the issue of freezing your accounts so that you have that moment of security, sensing, well, I've frozen this now. Nobody's going to get in there and use that information, despite this big thing. Well, remember, your life doesn't end the moment you freeze the account. At some point, you're going to need to unfreeze it. And that, as some people have experienced, that unfreezing your credit
to prove that you're you.
Yeah, can be more difficult than freezing it, you know, in the first place. And, of course, there's lots of reasons that you may find once you've frozen it, but now you have to use your credit in some capacity, even if it's only in a limited capacity, that you have to jump through flaming hoops in order to use a particular credit card in order to verify the information. Because remember, like I mentioned earlier, if you are in fact applying for a job, somebody's doing credit checks are very commonplace now in the employment world. There are companies out there that actually do some of these forensic checks for the companies that are doing the hiring. They get out there. What are they going to come back and they say, we don't recommend you hiring this person? I mean, so what do you mean? They know very little, if anything, about you. They didn't necessarily go in and check up and say, oh, this guy's a decent person. This lady's a decent person. It appears to me that she froze her credit after this problem.
Equifax
breach occurred or something like that. The level of inconvenience that it can cause can be problematic. Not even freezing completely stops the risk that you may take. It may not stop it because no one ever, there's not a lot of people checking credit. That's the first thing. If it's a type of identity theft out there for some reason that the lender is not really checking the credit bureau report about, then that is not going to help. In that particular case, you have to be fairly...
Well, there are other types of identity theft, too. Like, you see it for health insurance purposes. There's other types of identity theft that you have to be aware of.
Well, a big one right now is we're coming towards the end of another year, is that we're coming also to the end of tax time.
Taking your tax return.
A lot of people doing an early return, you know, and of course they advertise, you know, there's various services advertise for, you know, getting your money to you quickly and everything else, and it all can be done electronically. Well, it's amazing when a person actually... There have been cases where people got into February and March, and they're filing their returns, and the IRS come, and they think they're getting a nice check back. And then the IRS send when
so
they
we
send,
already sent that
they,
out.
They, you know, oh, we've already sent that out back, you know, early on in January.
Hey, one more reason to do good tax planning during the year and not get a tax return, right?
And not get a tax return.
No, I'm a huge proponent of having the smallest tax return possible, if any.
Yeah.
So
now, once you do your taxes, look at them carefully, and then maybe sit back and do some tax planning for the future, and determine how much money should be withheld or not withheld from your W-2 or from, you know, your tax return.
Nobody wants to owe the IRS money, so if you owe a teeny bit at the end of the year.
Yeah. Well, anyway, part of what we wanted to discuss on tonight's program goes into the fact that with all the rhetoric and all the talk you hear, if you're listening to talk radio dealing with money and finance, or cable television like CNBC and other financial networks, is that they talk an awful lot about various types of strategies, ways in which you can make money. Everybody wants to have some sort of a leg up, some sort of an advantage that they can take. So we come into a period in the economy, and we're coming to the end of the fiscal year for institutional money managers like mutual funds and hedge funds and others. August the 30th is the end of their fiscal year. Now, for you and I as retail consumer investors, we have until December the 31st, literally the last trading day of the year, to put through trades that allow us to exercise some of the various strategies, Donna, that you use working with clients.
Offset client capital gains.
Well, yeah, granted, a lot of client accounts may be IRAs, so that may not matter. But there are plenty of accounts that are joint accounts or taxable trust accounts or individual accounts. And buying and selling stocks and bonds within those portfolios, the timing of it, the nature of it, the way in which you exercise wash sale type understanding the rules can save you and even make you and even save you an awful lot of money. But
sure,
you get to the end of the year. This becomes a busy time of year here in September and October because it's the end of the fiscal year for people who manage billions of dollars of money that is out there. Now, what are they asking? Well, if you listen to the financial media talk, then a lot of what they're doing is they're saying, well, in this economic environment where the market is trading at the following multiples, where would an investor, an opportunistic investor, be looking in order to take advantage of the economy at this point, political opportunity or lack thereof in Washington? There's always some place that you can make money. And when we come back from this break, we're going to talk about not specifically a style of investing, but sectors of investing that may be opportunistic right now. This is the Money Talk program, Get Back to Basics with Donna Allard and Don Sowa. We're going to be right back, so please stick around.
This is Money Talk with Don Sowa, exclusively on AM 790 Talk and Business.
And we welcome you to the second half of tonight's Money Talk program. What we mentioned as we went off from the last segment was that we're getting into a time, now it's not unusual that it would happen here in the third quarter of the year. I mentioned just briefly that institutional money managers are often closing accounts. It's the end of their fiscal year is October the 30th. And so they're doing a lot of window dressing. So there's going to be a lot of account activity. But they're also going to be in the process, even shortly thereafter, positioning their portfolios and allocating where they want money invested based on opportunistic considerations. In other words, this entire year, 2017, has been driven by speculation. And maybe you may say, well, that's always the truth in the markets. Well, it's the old phrase that you used to hear out there was the market, you buy on the rumor and you sell on the news. Mm-hmm. I've changed that because this year I say you buy on speculation and you sell on reality. We have a new political environment in Washington, D.C. The House and Senate are in the hands of the Republicans. The White House is in someone's hands. Well, it's in the hands of the winner of the Republican nomination. Now, there are people who would argue, and I've heard this from Democrat friends and Republican friends, that Donald Trump's not really a Republican.
Right.
Which is
all that I meant. Yes.
He's a trumpeter. I guess so. He's got his own new party. But it's this speculation part comes in because they do believe, whether he is has a very strong loyalty to a particular party or not, they do believe that there's certain philosophical elements to who he is that he is loyal to. The idea of wanting
pro-business.
Pro-business, pro-growth, would embrace, much like conservative Republicans to some degree, a pro-growth agenda in terms of changes in regulation, a reduction potentially in regulations.
You know, there's been a concern, at least across more progressive political minds, of deregulation, especially when it comes to consumer protections and business and in the financial sector. And I heard someone from Fidelity speak this morning and said not to be expecting really deregulation, but more of re-regulation, and the idea that you're not going to see, you know, Dodd-Frank be repealed or anything like that, but there may be certain elements of it that are, you know, pull back on in terms of regulation, and that could, you know, promote. That would be seen as a pro-business, pro-growth sort of
the other
move.
Thing that they did do, and I heard this from a constitutional lawyer probably a year or so back, and they were talking about the Dodd-Frank and other bills like that. They said people don't understand. They don't get rid of anything. The regulators,
the SEC,
and others, they don't get rid of things. They go in and they write new regulations which circumvent the old one. So it's not the old regulation may be still in the books somewhere, but it's now moot.
Well, you know, one of the things that we talked about when Dodd-Frank was originally was being implemented, the idea of the stress tests on banks, and that you treat a small regional bank the same way with the same rules that you're treating major banks like a J.P. Morgan Chase or a Citibank.
And the big banks have the resources to accommodate that.
It's just absurd, but it's strangling for smaller banks.
Well, the cost of compliance is outrageous, and it makes the smaller banks unprofitable. Many of them would just go under or be bought out by someone else.
And unable to, you know, really efficiently utilize capital when they have to be holding on to so much of that.
Well, anyway, you have a new administration steps in, new legislative considerations in there. The thought process is, well, anything that's pro-growth, anything that's, you know, anti-regulation, you know, if the Congress can put a bill together like that and put it on Donald Trump's desk, he's going to sign it. So there was an expectation of rapid movement in a certain direction, and it never really came out. It never really happened, but I found it fascinating when you go to breakfast meetings like the one you went to this morning, and you're talking to representatives of large investment firms like Vanguard or Fidelity or T. Rowe Price and others. They're looking out at the mix of tools that they have within their portfolio. Fidelity, probably as much as anybody, has the broadest portfolio out there in the investment world. And
no lack of choices,
but they always want to make sure. I mean, if they're talking to professionals like yourself, who actually manage other people's money for a living, and also come to a radio station on a Tuesday evening and talk to our listeners who are out there driving home and telling them what things should they be considering, what things should they be thinking about.
Well, when you think about the way you put together a portfolio, one of the first things that comes to mind is that you're looking for diversification. Why are you looking for diversification? Because you want to put eggs in the basket or pieces of the pie together that are not all going to do the same thing in every environment. You don't want everything to be perfectly correlated, right? You want some things to react differently in certain environments so that everything is not up at the same time, and likewise, everything is not down at the same time. Typically, when we put a portfolio together, I mean, if you look at your own 401k, if you go in and look at the way things are organized, the funds are probably going to be organized by market cap and style box, meaning...
How big is the fund?
Is it a large cap, mid cap, or small cap fund? And would it be considered a growth fund or a value fund? Sometimes a blend. That's typically how things are going to be labeled in the equity area.
Of course, the theory is that if you are buying small company growth holdings, then, you know, maybe you're looking at something under $2 billion in size. That's the company itself is worth, its market cap is $2 billion
or less.
Under
2, and then, you know, 2 to 10 is your mid-size.
Now, accept the fact that a smaller company is going to ask you to take some more risk with them, but they also have potentially far greater growth potential going forward.
Certainly.
So
higher standard deviation.
Yes. So yeah, you're looking at the risk reward concept, but it's why you would choose small cap growth if you think that the large cap marketplace is now overpriced. Those big companies have gotten really, really expensive. And here we are. We have not had a major correction of any kind since really 2008.
Right. But one of the problems when you look at your portfolio only through that glass or only through those filters is that there's a certain amount of fluidity between the different styles. So what's a value fund today could, meaning that it's, you know, about, what is it, 20% below?
20% below book value, right.
That, you know, that could be a growth fund in, you know, a month or two. And so if you look at the S&P 500 over time, the way companies go in and out of it, and that's going to be based on market cap, is pretty high. I mean, you can have changes of anywhere from, you know, depending on what's going on in the market, anywhere from like over 100 changes in one month to like 40 changes in another month. So funds are coming in and out, and it's not a perfect way to categorize or identify a particular security. If instead, and this is what you alluded to before, you're looking at sectors, a security doesn't typically change its sector because the sector is determined by, you know, what drives revenue. So if you're a pharmaceutical company, well, your revenue is driven by, you know, selling drugs. If you are an airline company, you generate revenue by having people buy tickets for your airline and flying them places. If you're a financial services company, you generate revenue through, you know, fees charged, interest charged, you know, on mortgages and stuff like that. So the driver of your revenue is going to typically stay the same, so you'll stay in the same sector. So that's a different way to look at organizing your portfolio, a different way to look at putting it together.
So the speaker this morning, who from Fidelity, and I appreciate that he's from Fidelity because they were the people that actually invented the idea of sector investing.
They did.
There were ever an ETF, exchange-traded mm-hmm. fund, which really focuses on that, they had their select portfolios in just about every category.
He said that people would call up and, you know, hear about whatever the hot sector was to invest in and say, how can I invest in healthcare stocks? How can I invest in, you know, utilities? And so they then created sector-based mutual funds.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is that if you think about it, events. So there are investors who are going to be opportunistic in terms of event investing. For example, I'm not going to use the word celebrated, we just recognized the anniversary of 9/11 yesterday. And 16 years ago. And if you recall everything that happened there, they froze air traffic for mm-hmm. a period of time. People were suddenly not traveling. And even after they unfroze it, people were afraid to travel.
If you were a contrarian investor and you, quite frankly, had the gumption to do it, you could have invested in airline stocks at the time and made.
Well, they dropped down.
Or transportation in general, I guess.
In other words, at the very beginning, you might have said, areas that are going to be hurt in the short term in this environment are going to be the airlines. They're going to be transportation stocks. They're going to be tourism. There's a whole, you know, you go down that whole list. But you might think that
the market wasn't doing so well at the time anyway, if you recall.
Well, yeah, it gets,
we were in the middle of a bear market.
It gets to be tough. But so the speaker this morning was saying that people should be focusing less on what style will do best in this economic environment where the economy is growing at 1.8 to 2%. Mm-hmm. Instead, they're saying there's opportunity in sectors.
Certainly. And part of that opportunity comes from what you were alluding to before, you know, what kind of political environment we're in and what kind of expectations we have from this administration for regulation going forward, but also, you know, where we are in an economic cycle.
Well, you know, when there was the possibility of Hillary Clinton winning or even the strength of the Bernie Sanders, the belief was that they were going to be much more to the left in this particular case. They would be terrible for the healthcare sector. They would be terrible.
We remember in 2015 her comments about, I think it was Gilead, right?
Oh, yeah, drug stocks, biotech. And those industries took a hit. If you want to be, but they would, in each case, you look at them and say, if they're going to reduce regulation, though, across the board, then maybe financial services would be a place that would benefit from that potentially, looking at the way, especially because the rhetoric that you were getting.
And even though healthcare took a hit after those comments, and it actually did negatively last year, you know, just based on demographics, we've got to be moving in one direction when it comes to healthcare spending, right?
Well, we're going to give you some specifics. When we come back to the last segment of the show, we're going to talk about one particular sector, the financial services sector, that the analysts are talking about and suggesting that there may be some opportunities inside of a portfolio using investment tools like exchange-traded funds and indices that invest specifically in financial stocks. This is the Money Talk program. Get back to basics here with Donna Allard and Don Soa. We'll be right back.
This is Money Talk with Don Soa, exclusively on AM 790 Talk and Business.
And we welcome you back to the Money Talk program. During a large part of tonight's show, we've been talking about style, but in sector investing. In other words, not just saying, oh, we're going to invest in a value stock, which means it's priced very cheaply. Admittedly, we're, you know, in this particular economy, the low-hanging fruit has probably been picked. In other words, there were not a lot of cheap stocks out there. So I imagine the value managers, although they can find value, are pretty much challenged in trying to do so.
And when you purchase a, you know, value mutual fund, whether it be, you know, a mid-cap or large-cap or small-cap, you can technically be getting stocks from across all sectors, right? Because it's not specific to an industry or specific to a sector. It's you can get some financials, some infotech, some biotech. You could get anything in there from any
so
sector.
If you had, like we were mentioning, the financial services sector, you could invest in, like Fidelity years ago came out with Fidelity Select Financial Services. Then they even got more specific and say Fidelity Select Brokerage, Fidelity Select Insurance, Fidelity Select.
That's getting really specific.
Regional banks. They not only banking, but regional banks, which should be the smaller mid-sized companies.
So you're even drilling deeper than just going to a sector fund. You're getting into a specific industry.
Yeah,
fund
and they really allowed you to go in. That was actually the first place you could, for the average investor in their mutual fund portfolio, could actually buy gold. Although they were buying more of the gold stocks of the companies, although the portfolio...
Like gold miners, yeah, stuff like that. But the
portfolio did have some bullion in it as well. But you weren't looking at abilities. There were no exchange-traded funds in those days, for the most part, which just mimicked a specific focused index in a lot of different categories. Now, of course, you can do that. Now, we got to understand something. We're talking about the fact that there are analysts out there. There's the big strategists at big companies, whether it's the Vanguards of the world or the Fidelities, who are saying there are sectors out there that are going to represent some advantage. Now, whether or not the Trump administration and Congress wants to go in and restrict pricing for drugs and for, you know, biotech research, that if they really did a big push on that.
I mean, they're less likely to do that, let's be honest here. Yeah. Like, actually, like, restricting individual businesses, I would think they're less likely to do that.
They're less likely to do that. And, of course, we've seen, although there was some, upon the election of Donald Trump, who had, as part of his campaign, talked about ridiculous drug prices and how he's going to go in and negotiate and make, you know, take Medicaid and Medicare, that are big drug buyers, and use the strength of that influence to control and to negotiate better pricing from the drug companies. But there's a lot of fundamental issues that are economically driven that will affect drug prices. It's not just greedy big drug companies putting big pricing in there, although we've had a few examples where that is true. But among the areas, if they're going to focus on the reduction in regulation, changes in regulation, doing things that will help business grow and profit, and, of course, from the administration's perspective, create jobs, then one of the sectors that may do well in that environment potentially is the financial services sector.
Certainly, and it's not just because of, I mean, certainly part of it is for the potential for deregulation. Also the potential, you've talked about it many times, for repatriation of money that's overseas. So if we see, you know, that come through as a tax break, even if it's a one-time thing, that would certainly be helpful. But also, you know, where we stand in an interest rate environment, eventually interest rates will go up. But even now, as it is, there's a lot of lending still available with lower interest rates. So, I mean, there's...
It's interesting. Some banks would like to see higher rates
they
so they can add to their, you know, charge, give you, pay out more for money markets and CDs. But among the more purist, not perfect, but purer ways of investing in the financial services sector, rather than going through all the different fund companies that may have a fund, an actively managed fund in that category, I do kind of like the idea of going with the index there, the exchange-traded fund, and I'm going to go with the iShare here because it's the one I know best, which is IYF is the symbol. It has a very low expense ratio, so that the expenses to run that fund internally are about 0.44% or 44 basis points. For the last 12 months, the one-year return on it, the total return, that would be reinvested dividends as well as the capital gains, is about 27%. Five-year average, about 16.1. Now, when you, I thought it was interesting, when you added in the 10-year average return, it suddenly drops to 1.15, but that includes 2007 and 2008, which were really not good years for the for the financial services
sector.
We
are a couple years away from being able to take those out of our 10-year averages. I mean, we don't know what's going to happen in the next couple years, but at least we do know that we are a few years away from getting those out of our 10-year averages.
But if you buy the ETF, among the things, if you look at the top, say the top 10 or so holdings, you've got Berkshire Hathaway being the largest, J.P. Morgan, then Bank America, then Wells Fargo, then Visa, Citigroup, MasterCard, Goldman, U.S. Bank Corp, and Chubb, which is, of course, an insurance company.
I was going to say that's the only insurance company in the top 10, but there will be other insurance companies in there. Someone brought up a good point this morning about insurance companies, given what's happening on the property and casualty side after Harvey and Irma, and we're still in hurricane season. And the answer I just want to share, if you're concerned about that, is that, you know, that's in the near term, you might see a negative impact, but long term, it does not have a negative impact. In fact, smaller companies get out, larger, better off insurers remain strong and reinsure, and sorry for people being insured, but have the opportunity to raise rates.
Well, Berkshire Hathaway is a big reinsurance owner
huge,
as part of their
huge.
Big mix, too. So they know where the money's to be made. Warren Buffett has often talked about that. Listen, folks, it's just an opportunity, perhaps not with all of your money ever. Talk to your financial advisor if they do, in fact, use exchange-traded funds or ETFs in the portfolios with your portfolio. Ask whether that's appropriate based upon the advisor's knowledge of you and your goals, whether or not adding a sector, not specifically a style, but a sector like financial services, if it's appropriate
or
for
another.
You.
Yep.
We don't recommend anyone do that, but we want you to know about it because these are the kind of questions you need to be asking your financial professional.
A way to add alpha to your portfolio.
That's value added. Hey, folks, thanks for joining us here on the Money Talk Get Back to Basics program. Donna, thanks for joining us today.
Always glad to be here.
Folks, tune in tomorrow. Steve Beauvais will be here at 5 o'clock with more Money Talk right here on AM 790. In the meantime, you have a terrific evening.